So you got
Good morning. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2019. It's 9 a.m., as I'm sure you are all aware. And this is panel 4105, entitled The Supreme Court Defining the New Normal. My name is Scott Skinner Thompson. I'm a law professor here at CU Boulder. I'm thrilled to be moderating this important panel. Thank you to all of you for being here early on a Friday morning. We've got a great lineup of panelists who will be providing insights on the changing dynamics given the contentious confirmation battles of the past few years and new justices on the Supreme Court. The panel will examine, among other topics, whether the court has become overly politicized and partisan or will continue to serve as a meaningful, independent check on the political branches. And they'll also potentially examine what areas of law are likely to see significant changes in the years to come. After I introduce the panelists, they'll each give about 5-minute introductory remarks, followed by a question or two from me, then questions from all of you. In terms of audience questions, in this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also simply raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of the producers. Please try to write legibly. If you are a student, please note this in your question. We like to give a measure of preference to student questions. Also, please try to make your questions as brief as possible. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce our one wonderful panelists who will be speaking in the order I introduce them. To my immediate left is Professor Stephen Presser. He is the Raoul Berger Professor of Law Emeritus at the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law and the Professor of Business Law Emeritus at the Kellogg School of Management. He's currently serving as the visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy here at the University of Colorado's Center for Western Civilization Thought and Policy. Among other topics, Professor Presser is a leading legal historian and expert on shareholder liability for corporate debts. Professor Presser taught a class at the law school in the fall to what I understand were exceptionally rave reviews, so I want to thank him for joining us at the law school in the fall and for joining us here at CU for the year. To Professor Presser's left is Ian Millhiser. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the justice editor for Think Progress. He's a frequent commentator on legal developments at the Supreme Court, and he is the author of, among many other things, a book entitled Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Most importantly, from my perspective, as a fellow alum, Ian is a graduate of Duke Law School. Then we have to Ian's left, John Eastman.
Ian's left, I want to emphasize that.
Professor Eastman is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service and former dean at Chapman University's Dale E. Fowler School of Law. His work focuses on constitutional law, legal history, and property. He also leads the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, a public interest law firm established with the Claremont Institute that he founded in 1999. He serves as the chairman of the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. Prior to joining the Chapman faculty, he served as a law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court, and he has himself argued before the Supreme Court on some occasions. He's also a frequent commentator in the media. Finally, we have Professor Sarah Krakoff. She is the Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs and Research at UC Boulder School of Law, where she's also the Moses Lasky Professor of Law. Her areas of expertise include American Indian law, environmental justice, natural resources, and public law, land law. Last year, Professor Krakoff was the recipient of the Hazel Barnes Prize. This is CU Boulder's highest faculty honor and is awarded awarded to the professor who best exemplifies the enriching interrelationship between teaching and research, and whose research has had a significant impact on students, faculties, colleagues, and the university. She's also received the 2018 Chase Faculty Community Service Award from the University of Colorado for her pro bono work in underserved rural areas. So welcome to all of our panelists. As I said, we'll hear introductory remarks from each of them for about 5 minutes, and then we'll begin a discussion. So, Professor Presser.
Thank you, Scott. Our assignment is to figure out whether we can expect a new normal on the Supreme Court. Now, that requires that we figure out what the old normal was, if indeed we had one. And at the risk of being provocative, I think that we've been passing through a period that I regard as abnormal since the time of the Warren Court, or maybe even the New Deal. So about 80 years now, we've had an abnormal. To eliminate this, remember President Trump's recent comments and those of Chief Justice Roberts regarding who is on the federal bench. The president lamented that Obama judges were finding his policies unconstitutional. The Chief Justice, who claims that judges are umpires, just calling balls and strikes, trumpeted, "We don't have Obama judges, or Bush judges, or Clinton judges. All we have is sensible federal judges trying to implement the law." This was, of course, blatant nonsense from the Chief Justice. We are at a weird political moment when our judges and justices are, in fact, committed to different strands of jurisprudential theory. The current normal, then, is a clash between those two theories. Liberals, progressives, and Democrats in general believe that we have a living constitution that changes with the evolving standards of decency, equity, dignity, and fairness in American society. Republicans, on the other hand, believe that we must interpret the document according to its original understanding. And I imagine you've all heard of Antonin Scalia, the late Antonin Scalia's view. Responding to the living constitution view, he used to say, "The Constitution is dead, dead, dead." Unfortunately, that's not the most effective political slogan, but it is evocative. Curiously, though, it's the Republicans who have the more democratic view, if you subscribe to Federalist 78, in what Alexander Hamilton wrote. Justices, by faithfully interpreting the Constitution, just carry out the will of the people expressed in their Constitution. Now, the truth is, that's arguable because the people as a whole didn't really ratify the Constitution. But the Constitution, as originally understood, is a good way to restrain arbitrary power and thus promote popular sovereignty and the rule of law, which is what we mean by Republican small r government, through separation of powers and federalism. Now, that's the view, too, of the Federalist Society and, believe it or not, the expressed view of the President, Donald Trump. It's something a little bit different from a view that you find Anthony Kennedy expressing in the notorious Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision, the creed of the progressive view these days that, quote, "at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under the compulsion of the state." I'm not quite sure exactly what that means, and I'm not quite sure that it's a good central principle for jurisprudence, so I tend to adhere to the conservative view. Now, we'll spend a little bit of time probably today trying to predict what justices will do, but that's a very, very difficult undertaking. These days, they're under pressure from public, press, colleagues, Congress, and the Academy. Chief Justice Roberts, who we thought was a reliable conservative, seems to be shifting to the center, and I think it will probably take one or two more justices from Donald Trump seriously to change things. Now, I think we're in a very, very unhappy jurisprudential situation, and I blame the law schools. And indeed, I wrote a book about this called Law Professors, Three Centuries of Shaping American Law, and none of your homes should be without a copy. And I think that might be a good place for me to stop.
All right. So I'm sure that I'll have plenty of opportunity to disagree with Stephen, including over the suggestion that I want anything to do with Anthony Kennedy. But I will start with a point of agreement, which is that I agree that we have been in an era of political courts for a very long time. I would date it a lot longer than he would. And we're talking about the institution that gave us Dred Scott. We're talking about the institution that, for most of the late 1800s and early 1900s, would strike down any form of progressive labor legislation, minimum wage, laws restricting the number of hours workers could work, laws allowing workers to unionize, based on sketchy interpretations of the vaguest provisions of the Constitution. So it has always been a political institution. It has always been an ideological institution. But we have right now the most partisan court we have ever had in American history. There are three things that I think are different about this era. And so what I mean by the most partisan court is that since 2010, when Justice Stevens was replaced by Justice Kagan, we've had a coherent block of five Republicans who in politically charged cases tend to group together, and a coherent block of four Democrats who in politically charged cases tend to clump together. And that's never happened before. I mean, I went back and looked at all of the anti-canonical 5-4 decisions that we read in law school. For the lawyers in the room, Pollock was four Republicans and one Democrat in the majority. Lochner was three Republicans and two Democrats. Hammer v. Dagg. I mean, I've got a whole list of these. But anyways, the point is that for almost all of our history, the partisan affiliation of a justice has not been predictive of how they would vote in contentious cases, and now it is the most predictive determination. So that's one thing that's different about this era. The second thing that's different about this era is not only do we have a president who is not elected, but the two people that are unelected president put on the Supreme Court were confirmed by a block of senators that represent less than half of the country. That has never happened before. The first time in American history that an unelected president nominated someone to the Supreme Court and that person was confirmed by a block that represents a minority of the country was Neil Gorsuch. Second time was Brett Kavanaugh. And then there's the third thing that hasn't happened before, which is that there has never been a categorical refusal on the part of the party that controls the Senate to confirm anyone nominated by a president before they even know who that nominee was. And Barack Obama, unlike Trump, was elected. And the block of senators, the Democratic minority at the time that Merrick Garland was nominated, represented about 20 million more people than the Republican majority that refused to confirm him. So we have the most partisan court we've ever had. We have the use of some of the most aggressive partisan tactics we've ever seen in order to determine who controls the court. And all of this is happening in the context of a broken electoral system, which is no longer producing governments that in any way resemble the will of the people. And I think that's scary for quite a few reasons. I'll list two. One is that when people start to form a partisan identity, they start to act in terms of their partisan identity rather than exercising independent judgment. And so this is an indictment of either side of the court. I think that when five Republicans tend to group together, they will tend to engage in groupthink and think as Republicans. And when four Democrats vote together, they will tend to engage in groupthink and think of Democrats. And that is emphatically not what we want in a judge. We want judges to exercise independent judgment. But the more frightening implication is that courts depend on voluntary compliance. You know, it is possible to send out the U.S. Marshals to force a court decision, but there just aren't that many marshals. And if the courts are perceived as too illegitimate, a president of the opposite party could conceivably say that he won't send the marshals or she won't send the marshals to enforce a particular decision. So the reason why courts work is because people believe in their legitimacy. They believe that these individuals are rightly empowered by the law to resolve disputes and that we should all honor those disputes. And, you know, I guess since the title of this this panel is whether we are in the new normal, of course we're in the new normal. Now that this has been done, it's in no one's partisan interest to ever confirm a Supreme Court justice or even a judge of the opposite president's party if they have the ability to block it. We will never see a situation where, at least if there's a consequential sheet, if it's shift, if the balance of the court would shift, where a Senate of the opposite party confirms a nominee of the president of the other party. And over time, that is going to, if it hasn't already done so, that is going to destroy the legitimacy of the judiciary. Right now, there is one stolen seat. Imagine if there were three. You know, imagine if there were three seats that were held open because Mitch McConnell refused to confirm anyone nominated by a Democrat. At what point, imagine there's four seats, imagine there's five seats. At what point do you think the governor of California says, I'm not going to follow these guys anymore? And if the president wants me to follow them, they should send troops. So we're headed down a very dangerous path. And we are headed down this dangerous path because the legitimacy on the judiciary depends on the assumption that the judges are chosen in a fair way. That whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, you should have a chance of getting a justice on the Supreme Court that is proportional to your ability to win an election. And that is not the system we have right now, and I think it could end very, very badly for everyone.
On that cheerful note, Professor Eastman.
I just got to respond to a couple of things. First, you really lose credibility when you say the president is not elected. I mean, you know, you may not like it, but he was elected under the rules the Constitution sets out, which is an electoral college rule, not a majority of popular vote in the nation. So he was elected. The second thing is, he was confirmed by the Senate under those same rules. Now, if President Obama had done a better job on holding the Senate, he lost 6 Senate seats in the 2010 election. He lost 9 Senate seats in the 2014 midterm elections, then maybe he would have had enough political power to get his nomination through. The real problem here is that for about a half a century, the court has been acting politically rather than judicially in how it decides cases. It ought to be no surprise to us that when the court itself has taken on the role as kind of super legislature, people start treating it like a political branch because it matters greatly who gets appointed to those seats. I remember back in President Carter's, one of his appointments to the Ninth Circuit. People on my side, the political aisle, call it the notorious Ninth Circuit. How are you? Judge Harry Pragerson was asked during his confirmation hearings, if the Constitution was clear and it disagreed with what you wanted to do personally, what you thought was fair, which way would you rule from the bench, to uphold the Constitution or to follow your own personal views? And his answer, under oath, in that confirmation hearing was, I would follow my personal views. The senator said, maybe my question wasn't clear. I said, if the Constitution is clear. Pragerson said, no, I heard your question, and I would follow my personal views. And he demonstrated over the next 40 years of his career on the bench in the Ninth Circuit that he was serious about that. The law didn't matter if he thought it got in the way of what he interpreted as justice. When you've got judges acting like that, it's no surprise that we end up with a much more politically charged confirmation process. Now, most of the political charge has come on the one side. The Republicans did not block Ruth Bader Ginsburg, despite her politics, or Steve Breyer, or Elena Kagan, or Sonia Sotomayor. All of them got through with relatively large numbers. The kind of real serious attacks on the politics of the judge have come from the other side. Now, I also think it's not true that the key, the most politically charged contentious cases have been decided by 5-4 partisan votes. Look at Bush versus Gore. That was 7-2 on the fundamental issue of whether it violated due process. 7-2. People crossed the lines. Look at Justice Kennedy's trilogy of cases dealing with same-sex marriage and gay rights. Those crossed the line. Look at the abortion case out of of Texas last term. Look at the Affordable Care Act. John Roberts isn't a Democrat, and yet he voted to uphold that law. I'd say those are probably the four or five of the most contentious cases we've had in the last couple of decades, and they were not decided on partisan lines. And then finally, let me address the kind of 800-pound gorilla in the room, the Merrick Garland thing. Had President Obama not lost 9 seats in the Senate in the election before, Merrick Garland goes through relatively quickly. I'm sorry. Are you on the panel? And do you know the numbers? He lost 9 seats in the Senate. Okay. And what the Republicans did is follow the rule that Joe Biden had set out a decade and a half earlier, that because of the contentiousness of nominations, if a vacancy occurs on the Supreme Court while the presidential election is underway, this was the Joe Biden rule, we are not going to take up that nomination. The Senate under the Constitution has the perfect authority to do that. And they did nothing different than, for example, the Democrats did in refusing to consider Miguel Estrada's nomination to the D.C. Circuit for more than 2 years. So the partisan politics in the confirmation process is derivative of the partisan nature of judging that has occurred on the Supreme Court for more than half a century. We ought not to be surprised by it. Is there a way to get back to it? Yes, I think the way to get back to it is for the judges to take seriously their job of enforcing the Constitution as written. Now, let me just ask as a thought experiment, as my closing comment here. If you were to design the system without knowing any of the politics over the last half century, would you give the final authority on every major policy judgment, legislative judgment, without any clear constitutional text on the subject, would you give the final authority to resolve that for the whole nation forevermore to the unelected 9 people on the Supreme Court? I think all of us would say, that's crazy, and yet that's the system we've adopted. We ought not to be surprised that it's gotten contentious.
Great. Thank you, Professor Krakoff.
Well, speaking of contentious, I'll just confess, I am a law professor, but I'm not a constitutional law professor, and I'm not much of a Supreme Court watcher. My areas of interest and expertise, to the extent I have any, are in the fields of American Indian law, environmental law, and public land law. And those don't tend to be, frankly, well known at all in the public in terms of what the court does or how it approaches those issues. I do think that there are some interesting things to learn about the court's approach to interpreting American Indian treaties and the law governing the relationship between tribes and the federal government. And I'll wait and see if I have a few minutes to talk about that and whether there's anything we could learn. Here's one thing I do know, and maybe it is still remains the point of agreement, which is that the Warren Court was singular in that the Supreme Court at that time and then lower court judges during that moment, including Judge Pragerson, who my colleague here mentioned, had a view of enforcing the Constitution that should protect the rights of underrepresented minorities. And there were surely some excesses in that regard, but I want to put it in perspective. It was sort of a nanosecond in the life of the court. And I don't think any of us here can change any of you out there's politics or values. So I think all I'll say about it is, for some people, it was a welcome nanosecond. It was a sense that maybe what courts can do is protect underrepresented minorities in a country which, at the time, and we're talking about starting in, you know, the mid-1950s or so, was doing a relatively poor job overall of protecting the rights of underrepresented minorities, so that one branch would stand up and be willing to do so, one that had lifetime tenure, job security, and freedom from apparent retribution. You know, to some, that seemed like a good role to play in a particular historical time. To others, it seemed like a role that was inappropriate and stepping outside of what the Democratic branches were willing to do. And I think it's, frankly, legitimate and possible to see it both ways. And even if you're a defender of the Warren Court and much of its work, you might see, and there's a lot written on this, not just from the right but from the left, about the relative impotence of courts to carry out a broad social agenda. After Brown versus Board of Education, which, by the way, some of Trump's lower court nominees are now refusing to say was the right decision in that time, just to give us a sense of whether we're in a new normal or an old normal, was then decided but then not carried out, as we know, by a number of southern states and school districts, and then the court kind of backed away, and over the next several decades backed away more and more and more from any kind of role in engaging in sort of the nitty-gritty of enforcing what some people saw as social engineering and other people saw as maybe, you know, America finally sort of coming into its own. So we all agree, the Warren Court was unusual. I think the different responses to it are, so we need to get back to rights, right, where judges knew their roles and their place. I think there's much that's overstated, and I think this is where Ian and I do agree, about the extent to which courts were ever restrained. And if we focus only on the Constitution, we're missing the ways in which the court also does or doesn't engage in any kind of restraint when it comes to respecting the legislative branch, the Congress. So there's a lot of, I think, frankly, powerful rhetoric coming from certain segments on the right side of this political spectrum that has been incredibly successful with the public, that conservative judges follow the law as written, whereas liberal judges do whatever they want. And I just think that's a really broad and gross mischaracterization. And it depends on what kind of cases you're looking at. It depends on whether we're talking about interpreting the Constitution. It depends on what we think of the Constitution and what originalism might actually mean. I think there's a strong case that originalism meant that the framers, who were really an interesting bunch of very intelligent white men, thought that there were questions they couldn't possibly answer in their own time. So many of the constitutional provisions are intentionally vague. And maybe they intended us to interpret them in the light of our current day. That's also originalism, not necessarily so-called living constitutionalism, which, by the way, I agree, is a terrible shorthand. Maybe that's why it never caught on. It sounds like a kind of mold or something like that. But at the same time, I think there are ways that we completely overlook, as we get caught up in that either-or, either living constitution or originalism, the ways in which conservative judges seem much more likely today to strike down state and federal legislative actions. So who's actually acting in a restrained way? I think those monikers don't serve us that much anymore, in part because, and this is where maybe we all agree, the courts have become increasingly politicized, not only in a partisan way, I would add to this, in an ideological way. So I don't think it's just about different constitutional theories, unfortunately. I think then we could have an actual civil discussion about constitutional theories and when they should or shouldn't apply. I really think it goes deeper than that now with regard to who's being picked as judicial nominees and who's being confirmed and who's being blocked. It's sort of down to much more naked, not only partisan, but ideological interests and concerns. So to that end, I don't know if this is a new normal, an old normal. It just doesn't really feel like a really great normal. That's for sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much to all of you. To kick things off, several of you actually mentioned tone, and I do wonder whether or not there's been a change in tone, both on the court itself, in terms of how they communicate with each other in their opinions. I mean, one thing I noticed teaching constitutional law is that as we move forward in time, the opinions do in some ways become a bit more acerbic on both sides to a degree. And clearly, the Senate debates about these things are much more acerbic and contentious, and obviously the public debate about it is as well. And I'm wondering if the change in tone, assuming you agree that there has been a shift in tone, is contributing to digging the trenches deeper rather than allowing us to come to a broader consensus on the merits of legal issues.
I mean, I'll go. So some of this is just that we're in a country where, like, either party has a very good chance of winning any election, and when government is unstable in that way, that tends to produce extreme partisanship because there's high stakes. And so some of it is just, you know, what's going on in the courts is the exact same thing that's going on in every other political branch of the government. But I do think that the rhetoric you often hear from the right side of the aisle suggesting that they have discovered the only legitimate way to read the Constitution is unhelpful. I think it's useful to read the Constitution when we're discussing the thing that we're the thing that judges interpret. And so the Constitution refers to something called the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. It doesn't define that term, and the Supreme Court has said pretty explicitly it doesn't know what that term means either. It says that if you have a it says that if the police want to search you or seize your property, they cannot do so if it is unreasonable. It does not define the term unreasonable. It does not tell you which punishments are cruel and unusual. It does not tell you how much process you are due if you are denied liberty. It does not tell you what a public use of private property is. It does not tell you what a republican form of government is. It does not tell you what the general welfare of the United States is. It does not tell you what the words necessary and proper mean. Now, these guys are going to have some lovely interpretations of those words, and so do I. But the rhetoric you often hear from the right side of the aisle is that the way that you interpret those words is you go back and you find the meaning that they had at the time when they were originally drafted, and those words were just as vague then as they are now. So we are dealing with a document that is in some ways poorly drafted if you are interested in having a democratic system. And what I mean by that is when you have a vague constitution, you are delegating power to the unelected branch. You're delegating power to the judiciary to decide what they want those words to mean. In the 1930s, there were a number of doctrines developed that call for judicial restraint, that say that in almost all cases, law should enjoy a presumption of constitutionality, and there's a very good reason for that. The reason for it is because we realize that if you give judges unfettered space to read vague words like that, however they want to read them, it's going to lead to judges deciding on their own what they want the policy of the nation to be, and we won't have a democratic nation. I think those cases calling for restraint were correct. So, I'll see what these guys say, but, you know, to the extent that they are going to say that judges should not be in the business of deciding what our nation's policy is, then we are in agreement. But to the extent that they say that they have discovered the one true meaning of the Constitution and there is no reasonable way to read it some other way, I would advise reading the words of the Constitution yourself before you conclude that there's any such thing.
I'll make a very brief response to that. I'm having a lot of fun because I think I'm a moderate on this panel. Which is an unaccustomed position for me. But I did agree with every single syllable that John said. Sorry. It's interesting, Ian, to hear you say these things, because there's a deep conservative strain in your thought, I think.
There is. I mean, I was persuaded by the arguments that the Federalist Society made 15 years ago when I was in law school in favor of judicial restraint. I wish they had kept to the values they articulated back then, because they were better values.
Well, and maybe we can even agree that it's not really a great idea to have courts make policy for the nation. I think you were hinting that as well.
I was. Now, I will expand on that and say, so that when I said doctrines of judicial restraint, I was referring specifically to the Caroline Products decision, which says that there are three circumstances where courts do have to intervene. One is when there is an explicit provision of the Constitution telling them to do so. The second is when there is an attack on a group that has been systematically denied access to the political system. Think of the Jim Crow South. And then the third is when the elected branches make attacks on democracy itself, because in those cases someone has to step in or elections won't matter. But yeah, I mean, I think we are largely in agreement that in almost every case the job of the courts is to step away and to let Congress do its job.
And the other problem that we've flagged but haven't said much about is the current situation where we make confirmation hearings a political circus that amplifies some of the problems that you've mentioned. Felix Frankfurter, when he was nominated to the court, he was teaching at Harvard Law School, and he said, "I'm sorry, I just can't come down for hearings. I'm too busy teaching class." And he was still confirmed. I think we should return to that.
Yeah, I mean, the question was about the contentiousness of the judges among themselves. And one of the least known aspects of the court to the public is the collegiality with which they do their work. Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, was notorious for his acerbic wit in his opinions. It was rarely ever personal against the other judges. Occasionally it was. I think on some of the abortion cases he took out after Justice O'Connor for quite a while. But generally it was not. It was aimed at the argument or the lack of argument in the majority opinions as he saw it. And proof that this didn't carry over to the personal relationships, I think, was the relationship that Scalia had with Ruth Ginsburg over the years. Her opinions on the court came under some of the most strident language in Justice Scalia's dissents on occasion, and yet they remained the best of friends, to the point that she gave a phenomenal eulogy at his funeral. I think it's important to know. These folks are repeat players with each other, and they generally develop strong collegial relationships. Justice Scalia wrote the way he did because he was trying to influence a generation of the next layer of lawyers and judges. It's no accident that his opinions are the most widely reproduced in the law school constitutional law textbooks. When he says, if this is narrow tailoring, it's more like Omar the tent maker than Versace. That's a turn of phrase that gets people's attention. And so I think those kind of things were important. I do want to take up this notion that somehow the Federalist Society folks have changed their view of the judiciary to be more activist. When you are interpreting a statute, even interpreting a constitutional provision that is unclear, we want judges not to be activist. But if the judges accept a statute that exceeds Congress's authority, it is not performing the judicial role to leave that statute in place. Now, we could call that judicial activism. I'd like to say that the other is judicial abdication. Think about what it means. One of the things that's patently clear from our Constitution that is designed to have a federal government of limited enumerated powers. If we're going to have the judges defer to what Congress thinks ought to be the scope of its own power, we no longer have a limited Constitution. The very body that is supposed to be checked by the enumeration of powers and the limitations on those enumerated powers, Congress is now deciding the scope of its own power. That's not constitutionalism. That's unfettered power in the legislative branch. A judiciary that is restrained and not addressing those issues, those excesses of power, is not performing the other half of its fundamental function, which is to keep the constraints of the Constitution in place. And so as the conservative movement, the originalism movement, has kind of perfected its understanding of what it was about, the old anti-judicial activism line of the Warren Court has more solidified into judges need to be activists in enforcing the limits on the Constitution rather than abdicating that fundamental role in our constitutional system. And they need to be restrained in coming up with new theories on what the Constitution ought to mean if we were to write it today and then implement that. I think that's where the dividing line is. And then I fundamentally disagree with Ian that most of the provisions of the Constitution are vague and we can't figure out what they mean. Sometimes it requires that we get a better understanding of the language that was used and how it was used at the time. And I'll give one good example of this, and I'll close. There's a clause that prohibits the states from taxing imports. Now, we all today think imports means, Burgundy wine from France and, things coming from overseas. The word import at the time meant as much, you know, Maryland's importing tobacco from Virginia. And so we've got to understand it, what may be vague to us today had a very precise meaning at the time. And if the Constitution itself is going to reflect the higher law of the nation, those words mean something, and we've got to figure out what they mean and then faithfully apply them. And if we don't like it anymore, we have a mechanism to change it. And it's not nine unelected judges deciding how we would do it if we were writing the new Constitution. Because then you throw out the rule of constitutional law, you throw out the rule of law itself, and we end up being ruled by nine people who never had the authority to rule us. And I think that's the much greater danger.
You want in on it?
Are there other questions?
Sure.
I've been moderator before, so I know Scott has a stack like this. And
Thanks, Sarah. I guess building off what Professor Eastman was saying, moving from tone to talk about a substance of constitutional interpretation, I mean, there is a debate even among originalists, so-called originalists, about what that means. And Professor Krakoff gestured to this earlier, which is that the founders originally maybe never intended that their views of the world or their views of the Constitution should bind us in perpetuity. And indeed, that's a view adopted not by so-called democratic justices, but a view adopted by Anthony Kennedy, appointed by President Reagan, that the founders, as Professor Krakoff explained, never originally intended that their view of the Constitution should be binding forever. And so I'm interested in hearing more about that theory of constitutionalism, sometimes called living originalism.
Yeah, you know, I'll take that.
Or maybe I should.
Yeah. Go first.
That was so bold of me just to interrupt you.
I waited. I didn't know you were going to weigh in.
I was going to make a joke earlier, but then the tenor kind of changed. But I'll do it now. I was asked sort of late in the day to join the panel because I don't think that the organizers of the Conference on World Affairs wanted, despite the high regard in which we hold all these colleagues and their obvious credentials and smarts, to the new normal to look like that without...
Fair.
Not that there's anything wrong with the way they look. I'm not implying that at all.
We got different amounts of hair, all three of us.
You get my drift. I don't think that any lawyer or law professor, judge or whatnot, believes that many provisions in the Constitution are vague, and I don't think that's what Ian said. And I used the word vague, and it was a bit imprecise. There definitely are several key provisions in the Constitution which are open-ended, and intentionally so, because after all, as a famous justice once said, it is a constitution we're propounding or interpreting, right? Not a piece of legislation or a regulation, which can be much more detailed, often sort of annoyingly so, and bureaucratic. A constitution is a guiding document for a government, right? It composes a government. And I do believe that back then they knew what they were doing in that regard and weren't trying to prescribe a 500-page code of federal regulations or civil law, construction of a government. That's not what they were doing. And so when you're doing that, of course you can't and shouldn't anticipate everything. Again, the document would be way, way too long. So you set forth some core principles in addition to some very precise instructions. And in the core principles are words that are and should be susceptible to changing conceptions, such as the words due process, et cetera. And I won't go through and list them all. And of course, we don't all agree on that, but it's more than a legitimate proposition to suggest that the framers intended some words to be interpreted in light of circumstances over time, because they didn't have the hubris to think they could dope it all out back then. So that's the position that Scott's alluding to, that I alluded to vaguely earlier. And I do want to add just one more point about this judicial review debate that we're having and certainly won't have to the end or satisfaction. But I would say, we agree. Now there's a conservative position that judges should strike down federal laws, including laws of Congress, right? So the idea that some judges strike down laws and others don't, in that sense, judicial restraint is the habit of conservative judges and not, blah, blah, blah. You know, we can just set that aside. Nobody believes that anymore. I think what we need to keep an eye on, in my view, is not the judicial theory, right? We're striking down laws because they're unconstitutional versus we're striking down laws because, oh, wait, they're unconstitutional. Those are the left and right positions. It's what laws are we striking down? What are the values embedded in those laws? What constituency is represented by those laws, right? And then, of course, what kinds of constitutional arguments are recruited to strike down those laws? That's a very realist and much more political position, but I think if you track those, right, so in general, liberal judges would tend to strike down laws, and again, this is that Warren Court blip that kind of still lives on in some regards, that interfered with either equality rights, individual rights, rights of due process, right? Rights of individuals arguably underrepresented in a majority. The conservative judges tend to strike down laws passed by Congress that violate a provision of the Constitution, say the Commerce Clause, where the theory is not so much that there's a democratic defect in the passage of the law, but that there's sort of something fundamental about the legislation that goes against, again, some vision of the Constitution from, you know, the 1700s. And they tend to strike down, therefore, laws that are regulatory, right, that are protective, arguably, of the broader public, environmental provisions of environmental laws, provisions of healthcare laws, and so forth. So I would just say keep track of the values, keep track of the issues, keep track of what's being struck down and what's not. To me, that's actually much more reflective of what's going on in the judiciary and our politics right now than arguments about restraint versus activism. Those are very just not helpful and I think misleading.
So I want to take up more on the vagueness question and the new theory of originalism put out by folks on the left, that the founders themselves intended the Constitution to be a living document because they wrote some vague language and it was up to future courts to fill that in. And I'll give a good example. The death penalty, right? Does the death penalty violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment? You could say, well, cruel and unusual punishment is one of these clauses that kind of is designed to reflect the current norms of society. If it's unusual, if it's become cruel as we understand it now, that this clause itself morphs into to reflect the current understanding of the people. The problem with that is it has to confront the very precise language in the Fifth Amendment that specifically allows for capital punishment. And to read another clause in the Constitution as basically imposing a red line, excising one of the explicit clauses, cannot possibly be right. There are other examples of that as well. Due process, one of the arguments recently goes, requires that the children of victims of abuse be allowed to testify without having to be in the same room with their abuser. Right, and perfectly plausible to try and read that into notions of fairness, into due process. The problem is it runs directly afoul of a rather explicit and unambiguous text that says the accused have the right to confront witnesses against them. So to read one of the amorphous clauses in a way that contradicts explicit clauses is not originalism, it is something rather different. And it's not true that the founders intended us to have this kind of amorphous, well, we'll fix it down the road. Here's what Washington, I'm so glad I was given the opportunity to teach a class on Washington's farewell address earlier in the week, because I've been resorting to it almost all week here at CWA. Here's what Washington said. Our new Constitution is particularly well designed for the rule of law. Until amended, quote, by the explicit and authentic act of the people, it must be sacredly obligatory on all. That was their understanding of constitutionalism. If we have a constitution that actually doesn't constrain the legislative, the judicial, or the executive branch at all, then we don't have a constitution. All we have is a government that acts on its view of what the people think. right? And that's no constitution. And I'm not sure if, you know, if we removed it from any of the particular political fights of the day. Here's what else he says. Maybe one of these innovations might look like a very good policy outcome in the particular thing. But the precedent that is set by ignoring the limitations on each branch's power of government would destroy the notion of rule of law and the possibility of government. The Constitution is sacred until we decide to change it. And it doesn't get changed by Bruce Ackerman at Yale famously said it kind of gets changed. We have constitutional moments. I've also asked them, well, what's after your constitutional moment? What's the new constitution? I just want to know so I can comply with it. I take an oath to it if I'm elected to office. I want to know what it's changed to this moment and what's to stop it from changing tomorrow in a different direction. You know, nine people making those decisions for us is not very conducive to the notion that is the consent of the people is required to rule ourselves.
Okay, building off this conversation, I'm going to interject a student question about the court's protection for minority rights. I mean, I think one of the things the court has done, as a few of you have discussed, in its attempts to maybe more expansively interpret the Constitution is protect a variety of minority groups. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what happens to those protections if a more strict originalism theory of constitutionalism is adopted?
So I'll start. The primary provision of the Constitution which protects the rights of minorities is the Equal Protection Clause that says that no person shall be denied the equal protection of the law. And, you know, John, I think your distinction between explicit and amorphous passages of the Constitution is a good one. There are some passages that are clear. This is one of the vague ones. Because if you read it literally to say equal protection of the law, literally it doesn't tell you what kind of equality, so it seems to suggest that any kind of discrimination is not allowed. And that can't be right. The government is allowed to discriminate between unqualified and qualified applicants, for example, when it is hiring people. It's allowed to discriminate between rich people and poor people when it decides who gets welfare benefits. Like it's allowed to discriminate between murderers and not murderers when it decides who goes to jail. So some amount of discrimination has to happen in government. So the question is, what kind of discrimination? What the history tells us is that we know that the 14th Amendment was enacted in the context of the Civil War, which was a war over slavery, and it was enacted for the purpose of trying to end the kind, to ensure that the newly enfranchised freedmen would stand on equal footing with white citizens. So we know that racism is one of the things that it's intended to fix. But there's also another thing that we know about the history. The other thing that we know about the history is that I believe about 2 years before the 14th Amendment was proposed by Congress, Congress passed another law. It's a law dealing with contracting, which says that no one shall be denied the same contracting rights as a white person. And the reason why that is significant is because it tells us that the Congress of that era knew if it wanted to draft legal language that applies only to race, that simply says that only race discrimination is forbidden, it knew how to draft that language. And instead of drafting that language, it decided to use much broader language. And that suggests that the intention of that language is that it would forbid discrimination that is not just racial discrimination. And here is where we get what in the scholarship is often referred to as the line between interpretation and construction. What I mean by that is that we don't really have any way to just look at the language of the Equal Protection Clause and know for sure what is not allowed. But I think that the Supreme Court has done a pretty good job of putting meat on these bones. What the Supreme Court has said is essentially that the kind of discrimination that is not allowed is discrimination that is similar in character to racism, meaning discrimination that targets a group that has historically been subject to burdens, not because of anything that it is, not because of any kind of desert, not because it is less able to contribute to society, discrimination that is similar in character to racism. is the kind of thing that the Equal Protection Clause forbids. And that takes you to some places that the framers may not have intended. You know, we had a very sexist society in the 1860s. But when you accept the fact that that you have this vague provision, we know that it was intended to prevent racism, but we also know that it is broader than just a protection against racism, that it makes sense that sexism is something that is sufficiently similar in character to racism that we would want to forbid official sexism. You could say the same thing about homophobia. You know, there are a number of things that fall into this category. And so I am not laying out this theory with the arrogance to claim that it's the only way to read the Equal Protection Clause. It is what John referred to as an amorphous passage of the Constitution. There are many different ways to read it. But given that history, and given that the court was forced to go down a difficult path with a vague provision, I think that they have done a good job. I think we can be happy with the result that we want, and I think it also means that when you look at decisions like Craig v. Boren, or, I mean, Obergefell is a terribly written decision, even though it reached the correct result, but, like, when you look at decisions like that, you can see how a legitimate process takes place that's not just judges sort of making it up as they go along. It's judges trying to figure out from what they know of the language and the historical context of that language, you know, how that can be applied in a sensible way and in a way that is neutral, in a way that once you assert what the method is, you can apply that going forward, and it doesn't require you to just decide on your own what your values are. And it's not perfect, but in this case, I think they did a good job.
A quick comment on that. It's really interesting, Ian, that the guy who gave my chair to Northwestern Law School, Raoul Berger, wrote a book indicating that the purpose of the 14th Amendment was simply to uphold the constitutionality of the statute.
Yeah, that's
you mentioned
the argument.
The 1866 Civil Rights Act and not a charter for broad interpretation of the 14th. What's a fascinating question is the only way to protect minorities through expansive reading of the federal Constitution? And the answer to that has to be no. It seems to me that we'd be better off if we relied a little bit more on the Constitution's separation of powers and federalism and recognized that it's the task of state legislatures and the federal legislature to protect minorities simply as much as it is the courts.
So there we're going to disagree, because I'm pretty familiar with the state legislature of Mississippi. And especially with the state ledger of Mississippi in the 1950s.
And then don't we also have to ask, I mean, in many ways I agree, and which is, you know, citizens concerned about equality and rights shouldn't rely on the courts. And this is where I think, again, the nanosecond of the Warren Court, a lot of lawyers still believe, you know, in that holy moment, and it's time to move on and take to different venues in huge numbers, honestly, if those are your views. But sometimes you do that and you get legislation passed and then this Supreme Court strikes it down. I mean, there's Shelby County, right? So how do you calculate that into your sense that, A, the court is acting with restraint, and, B, if what progressives want is legislation to protect minority rights, they go to the legislature. Well, they tried that, and the Supreme Court has put a stop to a law that was quite successful in preventing various kinds of vote suppression in southern states.
So look, one of the more interesting aspects of our constitutional system, the principal power was designed to be exercised by the legislature. The courts were set up to be a counter-majoritarian branch of government, precisely to protect individual rights against a potential tyrannical majority. And so if I have a majority in Congress that decides to deprive a minority of the population of their rights, specifically enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights or in Article 1, Section 9 or in Article 1, Section 10, it is the role of the court to counteract that majority. One of the two principal roles of the court. The other is to make sure the other two political branches stay within their constitutionally assigned sources of power. Both of those are designed to uphold the rule of law. When I start deviating from that, the court's counter-majoritarian role starts taking on a super legislative power without even the backing of the consent of the population. And that's when I think it crosses the line from legitimacy to illegitimacy.
Great. We've gotten a handful of questions about court, what's called court packing, increasing the number of justices on the court. So how likely do you think this is? Would this just ratchet up the partisan nature of the court, or what would be the consequences if a president tried to appoint more than nine justices to the court?
Well, the one time it was tried, it failed rather spectacularly. The problem is I think what you flag, Scott, and that is we tend to think of the court as a representative institution, that you have to have the right number of particular ascriptive criteria among the members of the court, and I don't think that's healthy. I think we ought to, and the marvelous thing about this panel is I think we're all deeply committed to the rule of law, and I think if you go in that direction, you go far away from it.
So I wrote a piece about court packing a little while back, and court packing is very dangerous. And it's dangerous because once you do it, you have destroyed the legitimacy of the federal judiciary. And so the result of that will not be whichever decision you care most about will get to stick around. You know, do you think that the governor of Texas is going to allow abortion clinics to operate after a packed court reaffirms Roe v. Wade? So you are not going to protect whatever affirmative gains you want if you pack the court, and you're going to destroy the legitimacy of the court so no one's going to listen to them. And because the price is so high, I can only think of one circumstance in which it would be worth paying. And that would be if the court itself becomes an existential threat to democracy, such that the party that controls the court tries to permanently entrench the rule of that party. And in that case, you know, given the choice between no longer having a democratic system of government and no longer having a judiciary that has any legitimacy, I think you have to preserve the democracy first and try to rebuild the judiciary later. I hope that this court won't go there. I am worried that this court will go there. John Roberts has said some things in the past when he was a very young attorney, suggesting that he wants to strike down most of what remains of the Voting Rights Act. And if that happens, I don't think I have to tell you what the world looked like without the Voting Rights Act. We've already seen some states playing around with what they might be able to get away with. Alabama didn't just pass a voter ID law. They tried to shut down all the DMVs in the black neighborhoods. So we have a pretty good idea of what the world would look like. I hope the court does not go there, because the world they would take us to would be monstrous, and the things that might have to be done in order to combat such an occurrence would also be monstrous. But I don't think that the answer to the question, is court packing ever justified, is that it is never justified. I think that there are extraordinary circumstances that I hope never occur in which it becomes the lesser of evils.
Another related question we've gotten is not just about the number of justices on the court, but the confirmation process. And Professor Presser, you mentioned this in your introductory remarks, that the confirmation battles have become quite contentious. When should certain issues be on the table or off the table? Obviously, Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation raises these questions and puts them in relief. What are the limits? Are there any? Should there be? To what's discussed in a confirmation battle, why is it important to bring up issues of a justice's personal conduct in a confirmation battle?
I guess we can't go back to the era in which the only question was, is this somebody who really is a good jurisprude? Is this somebody who understands the Constitution? But I'd sure like to do that, and I would like to, if there were any way to do it, obliterate the notion that ideology dictates how you come out in a court decision. And right now, that's all we look at.
Just to press you a little bit, though, I mean, I think ideology is one thing and personal conduct is another. How do you feel about issues of people's personal conduct coming up in a confirmation hearing?
Well, if it's spurious, manufactured, untrue stuff, I don't feel good about it.
Well, I mean, I guess...
Professor Krakow?
I mean, these are lifetime appointments, and now people live quite a long time. Another thing I'm sure the framers did not anticipate, that we'd have people on the bench for, you know, multiple decades, spanning multiple shifts in society and so forth, and multiple presidential administrations. And so I do think that when you're up for a lifetime, one of the cushiest jobs in the world, lifetime job with tenure, with like clerks scurrying around to do all your work for you, that it is legitimate and important, actually, to know for the people to know, for the Senate to know as much as they can know about whether or not you are fit for that lifetime appointment. Now, we could all disagree about what is packed into fit, I do think, you know, it's hard to tell because things have gotten so partisan and ideological, and frankly, most senators aren't even listening. They don't care. They're going to vote the way they're going to vote in the end anyway, so there's kabuki theater aspect to every single confirmation process, which I know frustrates us all. If there's an allegation that a person up for a lifetime job with virtually no way to remove them has sexually assaulted someone, and I'm not going to say spurious or not spurious, I think that is a legitimate thing to look into, and I wish that both parties would see it that way. I mean, if you put it that way, if someone up for one of the most powerful jobs in the United States, these 9 unelected justices, has potentially committed and I won't even say crime, right, but engage in behavior that's far outside of all of our norms about how we would want anyone to treat anyone else, putting aside whether it is proven to be more likely than not or not, wouldn't we want to know before we put that person on the bench?
So I will add to that by saying this, which is that if I were about to hire an intern and I had identified an intern candidate that I thought would be very good, and right before I was about to make him an offer for this internship, a woman called me up and said, "I want you to know that this man tried to rape me," I would not hire that intern. Now, when there is the sort of public context that you have for a Supreme Court confirmation, I do think that there needs to be a public inquiry, because this was not a quiet phone call of the sort that can be handled with me simply hiring someone else. This was, you know, something that became a matter of public concern. But that public inquiry has to be an inquiry. And it has to be an inquiry that is done by people who haven't decided in advance what result that inquiry is going to reach.
So several of you have gestured to different limits on the justices, and one of the questions about a potential limit is a literal limit, term limits. How would you feel about term limits on the Supreme Court justices?
Yeah. I think something more is needed than term limits. Passing the baton from one judge who doesn't think he's faithfully bound by interpreting the Constitution to another judge who similarly doesn't feel bound by the Constitution doesn't solve the problem of the judges acting more politically than the role and the branch that they've allotted power has been assigned to them requires. I think there's got to be some other check. Now, the founders envisioned a couple of checks on the judiciary, from aggrandizing power to itself against the other branches. It thought it was the weak branch. That's borne out not to be true. Presidential elections and the Senate confirmation process were designed as a front-end check. There was also understood to be a more vigorous back-end check. the impeachment power was understood to remove judges who were inappropriately conducting themselves in office, not just as a condition of removing judges who committed off-bench crimes. In fact, it was a much more serious threat to the role that they were assigned under our Constitution if they ignored the limitations on their own power from the bench and committed some petty crime off the bench. But back in 1803, there was an impeachment process that was much more political, and the pendulum swung so that you can't touch judges with that original impeachment. And that means they are unchecked. And, you know, human nature, what it is, whichever political side, you know, side of the political aisle you're on, if you're unchecked in the exercise of power, there's a propensity to abuse that power. And any reform of the terms of office of the judiciary that doesn't address that underlying cause, I think, is a waste of time.
So I think the question about term limits is, what problem are you trying to solve? I mean, I think that there are examples, and I've heard from clerks who clerked on the court, where there were a number of very elderly justices that, like, there have been periods where you've had members of the court whose minds weren't as sharp as they used to be. And if that is a problem that you are afraid of and your intention is to solve that problem, then term limits are a way to do it. If your problem is that the court is ideological and you want a less ideological court, then this is not a solution that is tailored to that problem. I think that you need to look at depoliticizing the confirmation process itself, and I think there's several good models we could use to do that. There's the Missouri model, where you have a commission that's drawn from various different parts of society, and the idea is that the commission is diverse enough that it is more difficult for a political party to capture it. When there's a Supreme Court vacancy, the commission puts up three names, and then the governor picks one of them. And that model has been not completely effective, but more effective in getting politics out of the judicial selection process than what you see at the federal level. We could go to something like the French model, where in France, if you want to become a judge, you take an exam after law school. It's a really difficult exam. Only 5% of people pass. And then you go to judge school for 2 years. And then after judge school, you're then promoted through the judiciary by other judges. Now, the disadvantage of that system, why I think the French system has been more effective than ours in getting politics out of the system, is that once the judiciary becomes captured, it stays captured because they're the people making the choices. But there are other models for how to select judges that don't rely on having a partisan elected official name someone and then a 100 partisan elected officials decide whether that person is good or not, that I think won't take politics out of it completely, but if we want to make the court less ideological, we'll take some of the politics out of it.
Great.
I was just going to make a very quick comment. That's another place where you and I agree. I think that in Europe, nobody knows who judges are.
Yeah.
We have celebrity justices. I don't think that's a good idea.
Great. With that, please join me in thanking the outstanding panel.
Thank you. Thank you. That was fun. Yeah.